This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 17th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 127th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where last week we were neatly themed. This time we're in cautiously opening our windows to the elements of randomness. Slightly. But fear not, the wind blows fair. First of all, we welcome advertising legend John Hegarty to the show to talk about his many and varied successes. The man's practically a brand in his own right.
Ones who are enjoying what they're doing and who see the opportunity within it and have a sense of humour are the ones who seem to do the better work and sustain their creative careers.
And we head to the Adelaide Festival to separate the light from the shade in that city so busy at this time of year.
I think you always aim big with the programming and we've really gone down the epic route this year.
And we'll speak to one of the stars of Wes Anderson's wonderful new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Saoirse Ronan.
It's just delightful. It's lovely. And yes, it might not be necessary or realistic, but it's fun. And it's so enjoyable every time he does something like that, you know.
Plus, we'll take a tour around the Chinese wing of this year's Armory show in New York and enjoy music from the toad-worshipping Canadian songstress Chloe Charles. Don't worry, we'll explain all. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So I said we'll explain all and we'll keep you hanging on until a bit later on in the show on that toad question. For now, here's Chloe Charles, who joined us in session this week to play us tracks from her new album, Break the Balance, which came out last month. Chloe's from Ontario. She's stepsister to none other than Julian Lennon, and she's earned herself the respect of the music press when her first EP came out a couple of years ago. She's currently on tour and squeezed herself and her band into Studio 2 here at Midori House to treat us to a few songs from her new album, the first of which might be familiar to regular listeners on Monocle 24. This is Business.
There's a hole in a mid hole, and she can't seem to fill it up. There's a hole in a mid hole, and my heart can't mend it up. But why does she try to find an occasion to mend it up? One, all the while, search and hide for identity that she's not. But girl, I like your business. I like your business. Girl, I like your business. Whoa, let's have a good time. There's a crack in the ceiling, and we see right through the top. There's a crack in the ceiling, and the sky won't fill her up. But why does she try to find an occasion to mend it up? One, all the while, searching hard for identity that she's not. But girl, I like your business. I like your business. Girl, I like your business. Whoa, let's have a good
Chloe Charles in session for us there. That was Business, and there's more to come later on in the show. First, though, one of the defining ad men. John Hegarty has made a name as one of the key players of British and international advertising. A super creative, you might say, BBH, the agency he co-founded in the early 1980s, made some of the defining campaigns of that golden age of advertising. Nick Kamen's infamous launderette striptease to rebrand Levi's, getting the world to speak a little German to promote Audi, Vorsprung durch Technik, anyone? And getting legions of men to think with their aerosols. The Lynx or axe effect, if you're abroad, has been getting airplay for years. Hegarty's new book, Hegarty on Creativity, tells us there are no rules. That's fine for him to say, isn't it? Here is John Hegarty.
Could I see your papers, please? A lot of people say music is the greatest of all art forms. I disagree. I think it's the second greatest of all art forms. I think life is the greatest of all art forms. Therefore, we're all creative. You know, in a sense, we are creative. So it's instinctive without us realizing it. And I describe creativity as an expression of self. But you find that people say, of course, I'm not creative. Well, you are. And therefore, even as a practitioner, you're sort of using things instinctively. And when I did this, I sat down and thought, well, what would be the 50 things that I would say to somebody? Now, some are obvious, like, you know, start with an idea, don't become a cynic, juxtaposition one thing against another thing. But then as you think about it and you think about collaboration, it's a big word that we use today. We hear everybody say, oh, we must all collaborate and we're in a collaborative kind of economy and all that sort of stuff. And you go, well, to a certain extent, but great ideas come out of the mind of one person. It's driven by one person. So you've got to balance those things out. The reason actually I enjoyed doing it and I wanted to do it is that I've read so much about the creative process from people who never do it.
Yeah, right.
Who actually have ideas, who don't follow them through, who don't see success and failure with the ideas that they've had. They've not made them. They've not kind of, and yet they all write about it. This is how you do it. Sitting on a beanbag does not make you creative, let me tell you.
Heading back to the dark days of the 90s in an ad agency, isn't it? Right?
Not at all. Go to Shoreditch right now, and okay, there are more beanbags per square foot in Shoreditch than anywhere else in the world. And everybody thinks that's what makes you creative, and it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. And of course, journalists, you know, who observe creativity always want to kind of, well, what does it look like?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's all going on in your head all the time. I mean, technology has always been a driver of creativity. How we can get a story out there, how we can tell somebody something. Technology has been a fundamental part of that. Well, in the last 10 years, we've seen 15 years, we've seen a tsunami of technology hit us. But it's affected it in certain ways, but in other ways, it still remains exactly the same. We have to tell a story. Storytelling is fundamental to the basis of brands. And therefore, how do you get that story out? Now we have many, many more ways of doing so. So it's a very exciting time to be in, I think, in any creative industry.
And how much of it is instinct? As you said, this book isn't about advertising per se. It is one of the branches of the creative arts. At the beginning of the book, you talk about using your instinct. It comes from instinct. Presumably, this is something that, although everyone is creative, you kind of have to be born with the ability to trust your instinct, eh?
You do, in a way. I mean, it's like in the same way that we can all dance. I mean, I can sing. I mean, it is just truly appalling. I mean, and I could probably be
That's part two of the interview.
I could probably be trained to sing a little bit better, but not much more. I will never obviously be on X Factor, or some people who are on X Factor shouldn't be on X Factor. Yeah. So, yes, of course, there is instinct, and some people have the ability to judge ideas more so than other people. I think also it's about taste, I think, creativity, and having the taste to understand, because, you know, you're working on something and you have 10 ideas and you look at it and you've got to decide, well, which one do I think is the better one? You know, and that then becomes a matter of taste. Now, you can improve your taste. You can, I say in the book, surround yourself with great people. It will rub off, you know. I think you can develop your skills, but ultimately you have to have the instincts to do it. You know, the instincts have to be there, and that's fine.
are some key ads that we could talk about. The famous Laundrette Levi 501s commercial, which is same for people my age. I'm 36. I kind of felt that that was a TV show. I mean, I felt that it was on the TV so much, it became such a part of the kind of cultural DNA, the pop cultural DNA of that time. There's the Lynx effect, which is hilarious and has been much copied, I think, as well. I suppose that's another thing. And Vorsprung durch Technik, which is a tagline for Audi, which people, I think, probably thought Audi was born with, but it wasn't. It came out,
it came out late 80s. Yeah, the 80s.
Do you know a good idea is a good idea when you have it? I mean, something could potentially have that much cultural weight 30 years hence.
You don't. You don't. Yeah. You look at ideas and you think that could be really, really good. What captures the zeitgeist, what captures a kind of cultural wave is very, very difficult. Anybody who tells you they can judge that is a fool and a liar. But there are things that you look at in an idea. You look at it and is it challenging? Is it irreverent? Does it challenge the status quo? And is it expressed in a way which kind of possibly will capture somebody's imagination? I mean, for instance, when we went to Audi with and said, look, we want to sign everything off with Vorsprung durch Technik. They did some research and the research came back and said, whatever you do, don't do it. You know, so fortunately, we had a great client who said, well, we are German. We're a German brand. Why shouldn't we be proud of it? And they went ahead and did it. And of course, you know, the rest is now history.
And the moral of the story is, if you want to get on the beach before the Germans, you better buy an Audi 100. Vorsprung durch Technik, as they say in Germany.
I think it's very important to have a sense of humour if you want to be a creative person. It helps enormously. It doesn't mean to say you can't do serious things, but I have found when I'm working with people, ones who are enjoying what they're doing and who see the opportunities within it and have a sense of humour are the ones who seem to do the better work and sustain their creative careers.
And the sense of humour thing, I guess, is the thing that carries these ideas because it's the sort of wind beneath their wings. Man,
well,
that's a song that I really don't want anyone to sing.
well, certainly in advertising, humour is a powerful force because it makes you sit up and listen. You know, it's like the teacher in school. The teacher who you learned more from was the teacher who made you smile and laugh. And whilst you're doing that, you're receptive. You know, we know that.
We're talking about creativity. We're talking about hardwiring yourself not to be hardwired, I guess, to be open to anything and to be able to therefore do anything. But how much has advertising, especially with the new technologies, with digital, how much has it become an algorithm of creativity?
Well, there are those, of course, who are always trying to sell it as a now it's an algorithm and, you know, we can calculate and we can manufacture and can work it all out. I mean, you will always get these people who come along whenever a new piece of technology occurs and they say, this is it now. We don't need human input. We, you know, computers will do everything for us. I always and constantly remain skeptical of that point of view. I mean, people say the business has been revolutionized over the last 15 years. I disagree. I think it's been liberated. That's the way I would define it. Because what technology does, if you embrace it correctly, it liberates the creative process. It gives you more opportunities. The big change over the last 20 years has been the globalization of what we do. When we first started BBH, 90% of the briefs that we were working on were for UK campaigns. It's almost the other way around now. 90% of the briefs we're working on are for global campaigns of some sort or another. London's become a global centre for advertising and creativity. But the thing that really I think has changed is this liberation, as I call it, the way that now through technology, I can express an idea in so many different ways. And I find that very exciting. So what happens, though, is some people become so obsessed with the technology that they forget it's got to have an idea within it that actually talks to me. Because I don't just engage with the technology. The technology is a medium by which I receive something. Well, what are you telling me? Is it meaningful? You know, I always like to say to people, you know, I love the cinema. I absolutely adore the cinema. But I don't go and sit in the cinema and go, wow, this is absolutely amazing. I'm sitting in front of a great big screen and it's absolutely fantastic. And an image is going to be projected onto that screen with sound and Dolby and God. If the film's crap, I walk out.
It's the story, right?
Yeah, it's the story. Yeah. You know? So I always say when you have this phenomenal amount of technology that comes in, you have what I call a creative deficit. And that we become obsessed with the technology and we go, wow, you can do that now. Isn't that amazing? And we forget the idea. And then eventually creative people come in and go, wait a minute, I've looked at this bit of technology. Actually, what it allows us to do is this. I can tell a brilliant story. And I think in a way, in the last 10 or so years, we've been in this sort of creative deficit, as I call it. And we're coming out of it now. I did give this talk saying, can you name Gutenberg's second book? Because, of course, yeah, you know, he indeed. Didn't do a second book. But he was the, you know, he was the Steve Jobs, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Zuckerberg, whatever you want to name on you, of his day. Yeah. It's like Les Paul, the inventor of the electric guitar.
You wouldn't want to listen to any of his songs.
He did not write Rock Around the Clock. You know?
Yeah. And you mentioned the globalization of the industry, John. You've got offices in London and New York, unsurprisingly, but also Sao Paulo and Singapore. When we're talking about the sort of clean line of an idea, especially maybe an idea that's linked to humour, how easy is it to be funny or make that same statement with the same weight in those four cities, for example?
Well, I think it's very hard. That's the honest response to that. It puts different challenges in front of you. And it's not so much really that it's hard coming up with something that has a sense of humour and wit to it that can work around the world. It's actually now my stakeholders are no longer one person sitting in an office in Marylebone Road or wherever it might be, the head offices of that company. I now have stakeholders who are in Shanghai and some are in Sao Paulo. If it's a global campaign, and we've worked on big global campaigns for big clients, the problem that you now have is you have 10 people making a decision, and that becomes very difficult. So you have to try and encourage these companies, if they're really going to do something great, they've got to centralize the decision-making process. They've got to say, right, that person is going to decide.
I guess you always need to chat up the boss. Don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's become hard. So I think there are tremendous opportunities today. But like in all eras, there are always problems that you have to resolve. I mean, when I first came into the industry so long ago, it's embarrassing to even talk about it. I mean, people didn't really believe in creativity. And those days, the creative department was just, you know, another department. That we've now overcome. Now, people accept creativity as fundamentally important to the process. But now we have too many stakeholders, so we have to win that battle now. So there are always new battles you have to win.
And just finally, the chapter that really piqued my interest, or my favourite chapter, was the one that says, originality is dependent upon the obscurity of your sources. That's letting a little bit too much daylight in upon magic, isn't it?
Well, you know, as I say in that little chapter, you know, the word originality is bandied around in the creative world. There is no such thing as originality. It's like, I always think there's that word nothing. There is no such thing as nothing. How can you have nothing? It's nothing. Nothing is nothing. Originality is a nonsense, as I think I say in the book. You know, God was the last originator. The rest of us are copyists. And in many ways, you know, we want an idea to kind of relate to something else because then we see how it's changed and we appreciate the fact that, wow, it's done it like that. You know, Easy Rider, we talk about as a great movie. It was a great movie because it changed the way movies were made in relation to other movies. It wasn't original in that sense. Mm-hmm. So to stop people going using that word and try to find a word that is more relevant, that can be more helpful, is fresh. Is it fresh? Does it make me look at it again? Is it convincing me that I should see this in a different light? And that to me is fundamentally important about creativity. It's trying to get you to reassess, to relook at something. Of course, we don't like copying. That's appalling. But, you know, the fact that I've done something original is an arrogance.
It's a philosophy book as much as it is on creativity. The book is Hegarty on Creativity. There Are No Rules. And it's a handsome piece of publishing.
But, thank you. And I've got the special edition book, by the way, You Can Eat. And I have a recipe. I've shot a little bit of video with Anna Hansen of the Modern Pantry. And you can see Anna Hansen showing you how you can eat the book. So creativity is useful, you see. This is what we've got to remember. It's not just about decoration. So when you get the special edition book, you can also eat it.
That's nice, with the jam filling.
It brilliant.
Makes it all go down so much easier. John Hegarty, thank you so much for your time.
New links excite. Even angels will fall.
That was John Hegarty, whose new book, Hegarty on Creativity, There Are No Rules, is out now. And this is Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Over to Adelaide next for some highlights from this year's festival.
If you're in the diplomatic game, you could do worse than a posting in Rome, where you'll probably be put up in a palazzo fit for a pope. Monocle Films paid a visit to the ambassadors of Brazil and France.
Never before have embassies been so unloved. Budgets have been cut, buildings sold off, sales of Ferrero Rocher have slumped. Yet in Rome, a sense of that almost lost tradition, a feeling for what diplomacy should look like, still very much exists.
When in Rome, premiering in the film section of Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Over on the sweltering side of the world, the annual Adelaide Festival of the Arts has just wrapped up. And these days, the longest running and well-renowned event has to share its space with a host of other big-name crowd-pulling events, from a massive fringe festival to a very noisy V8 car race. But as Annie Hastwell found, the festival is still holding its own, offering a bouquet of the best theatre, dance and music the world and Australia have to offer. Among this year's highlights were some surprising Shakespeare interpretations and a film featuring coprophilia. Yes, look it up. You may not like what you find. But then, what's a festival if it doesn't push boundaries? Take it away, Annie.
Dit was de nobelste Romein van allen. Elke samenzweerder, alleen hij niet, deed wat hij deed uit afgunst jegens...
6 hours of Shakespeare in Dutch, and the audience are loving it.
You are free at any time to take a seat on the sofas on stage.
And loving the casual atmosphere in which the Roman tragedies are being presented. Letting them wander on stage and order food and drinks, and watch the drama unfold as they lounge in the couches that are part of the 24-hour newsroom set.
The strijd tussen Rome and Volsken is ten einde.
Tonno Group Amsterdam's unconventional rendering of Shakespeare's historical trilogy, Coriolanus, Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, was an early hit at this year's Adelaide Festival.
I think you always aim big with the programming, and we've really gone down the epic route this year.
Festival director David Sefton says Adelaide audiences have traditionally shown a taste for the maxi event.
I mean, the great thing about the history of this festival is they've always embraced the epic. The Mahabharata was in a quarry in the Adelaide Hills back in the 80s. And the 7.5 hour Seven Streams of the River Ota from Robert Lepage was here. Famously, Adelaide did the first ring cycle at the festival. So that sense of an ownership of the big and the large scale is what we're really building on this year.
One example of this is River of Fundament, Matthew Barney's radical reinvention of a Norman Mailer novel, a 5 hour story that moves between Egyptian gods and the seven stages of death and the rise and fall of the American car industry. Its controversial and sometimes gruesome content has already caused a flurry of public outrage and media coverage.
Yes, it's for adults only. Yes, it has adult imagery. Yes, he's an artist that uses contentious images. No, it's not for everyone. But everyone coming is going to know what they're letting themselves in for, and children aren't allowed in.
Also creating plenty of chat around town are Isabella Rossellini's Green Porno, exploring the sex life of insects, and a musical retelling of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Alone on a wide, wide sea, and never a saint took pity on my soul in agony.
British cult trio The Tiger Lilies bring their dark cabaret musical style to the classic Samuel Taylor Coleridge ballad of Doom on the High Seas.
Death ship ahoy.
And Shakespeare gets another run on this year's programme with a world-first Aboriginal interpretation of King Lear. The Shadow King has Lear as an Aboriginal elder, played by actor Tom E. Lewis.
The one in this very story, we respect the vein of Shakespeare and don't disrespect it. We've got a paintbrush and paint over the hills and turn it into our home and bring it home closer.
Time! We shall express our dark one purpose. No, with this determination, we're going to be rich! Yay! I have decided to...
No festival is complete without a few world premieres. Blackout is a theatre dance piece by Adelaide Portuguese duo Joe Stone and Paulo Castro.
Blackout is about a wedding celebration in a big boat.
Tonight, I got a feeling that tonight is going to be a good night. Yes. Tonight is going to be a good night. So let's get this party started.
Blackout is inspired by Joe Stone's experience of being in New York when the World Trade Center was hit and watching the reactions of those around her.
We have facades and we have social systems to keep our society running, and when they break down, the stuff underneath, the humanity underneath, good or bad, that kind of comes to the foreground.
It's about the panic of people when they are confronted with these kind of situations.
The Adelaide Festival originally styled itself on the Edinburgh Festival, and David Sefton accepts that comparisons are inevitable.
They do have different flavours, and there's no question that a festival like Edinburgh does skew more towards the classical. So you'll find a lot more orchestral programming and chamber music programming, and we don't really do that. And it's really about defining your priorities.
Local arts critic Samila Harris has been covering the event for over 40 years. She likes what David Sefton's dished up for this, his second Adelaide Festival.
You know, every festival director who comes to Adelaide has to find a path following the brilliant festivals of the past and one or two less magic ones. Sefton has come with a wonderful global perspective and lots of contacts and a quietly understated understanding of the way it really works and what we really want.
If Sefton is creating his own stamp on Adelaide's favourite art event, it's in his preference for the wilder edges of the music world. This year, he introduces Australian audiences to John Zorn, the American avant-garde composer, arranger, producer, saxophonist and multi-instrumentalist.
There really is no one else now quite like John Zorn. He's absolutely at the top of his game. He just turned 60, did a big tour last year of a sort of composite show, which is just a quarter of what we're doing. And what we're doing really is a substantial career retrospective. That basically because he's never been to Australia before. And he's an extraordinary artist.
For Monocle, at the 2014 Adelaide Festival, I'm Annie Hastwell.
Thank you, Annie. And the Adelaide Festival has wrapped up for this year. But if you want to catch up on all the highlights, just go to adelaidefestival.com.au. Still to come in part two, we'll find out how growing up in the forest has influenced this week's session guest, Chloe Charles. We'll check in at the Grand Budapest Hotel and check out China in Focus at the Armory Show in New York. Nothing short of spectacular. So I said earlier I'd explain why I described Chloe Charles as a toad worshipper, but it's probably easiest if she does it herself. She sat down with culture producer Katie Bilbur after the session, and this track, God is a Toad.
By the standards of your God, but in the little things and in the crickets and in the toads. Sitting with a bottle that's beaten, sitting with a bottle of wine, sitting in a bomb that's threatening and your God's not mine. Sitting with a bottle that's beaten, sitting with a bottle of wine, sitting in a bomb that's threatening and your God's not mine. Heaven, can I come to where you are? But my heaven's not yours. It's in the little things and in the crickets and in the little things that we are. So heaven, when I'm dreaming in the city,
Charles, thank you so much for coming to play for us. That was truly beautiful.
Thank you.
I wanted to pull you up on the last track that you played called God is a Toad, because I know that you have a particular affinity for toads, and I just wanted to ask you about that.
That's funny. Of course, people are drawn to that title. I grew up in the forest. I grew up in the middle of the country. We had a ton of toads, actually, and anytime it would rain, they'd all come and like hide under the balcony. And I just thought they were so cute. And most people think they're disgusting and ugly, but they're adorable. I'm not a particularly religious person in any direction, but I always say if I had to choose a religion, it would be nature. So sort of that's what the title means, but it's not meant to offend anybody.
And do you think growing up in the forest and being surrounded by nature has fed into your music then?
Yeah, definitely. I think I really am inspired, I think, by nature, and it's the one place that I can really find peace. It sort of ties everything together. So, you know, when you're writing about mundane little things, you know, and you think about the world and just how it exists in the environment, I don't know, it somehow pulls you in that direction. For the newer work, I'm trying to sort of be a little bit more positive and try to write things that also help make me feel like excited about life and everything. Because sometimes, you know, writers will just write about sort of when they're really depressed or heartbroken or something. But, you know, I don't want to wallow in my pain all of the time. Not to say that I'm always in pain. I'm not. I'm actually a pretty happy person. But so, yeah, so I'm trying to kind of cover all different directions at once and give like a better picture of what my life actually is.
And one of the things we should point out is that you were playing the classical guitar in the studio here. Mm-hmm. I know that's an instrument that you taught yourself and that you've been, you know, applauded for being a really good excellent classical guitar player. So tell me a bit about your relationship with that instrument and how much you use it in your work.
It's funny because when I picked it up at first, I've just decided I needed an instrument because I wanted to, you know, have full creative control and just be able to write songs and write what I heard in my head. So, you know, people are like, was it, you know, something that just drew you to the classical guitar? And I mean, it was a few things. My mom had played the classical guitar and her sister, and they wrote these beautiful songs. So I'd heard it all of my life, and I loved the warmth of it. But also, it's really practical because you can carry it. I mean, a piano, it's hard. And I travel all the time. So it's really helpful to have something that, you know, you can be anywhere and you can write a song. Yeah, and I've tried, it's funny, tried playing the acoustic guitar, tried electric, and I just never have that same connection. There's just so much warmth in a classical guitar. So I think I probably won't ever stray away from that. It's special. I don't know.
And you mentioned that you've been on the road a lot recently. You've been touring a lot last year and this year as well. I wonder how your music kind of develops while you're touring. Do you find that songs that you wrote and recorded a year or two ago change once you play them live a lot and you see how people respond to them? Or just, you know, when you're on tour, you've got all this downtime that you're filling with working on songs that already exist? Or
I find it hard to write, actually, when I'm on tour because, yeah, I think so much energy goes into traveling and then into just putting your energy into playing the show. But I find when I have the down periods between tours, I end up, you know, taking a lot of these experiences. And I mean, you can't help but be influenced by everything, even if it's, I mean, completely unconscious. And then, you know, all of a sudden have like this burst of creative energy and I'll start writing and I'll write a few songs in a couple of days. And then, you know, it will be a dry period for a couple of months. But yeah, definitely the songs develop when you play them live. I mean, I love doing that. And you get to see like, you know, how audiences respond and what they really connect with. And I think that's really, really important. I can't quite imagine recording a song without having played it live in front of an audience. I mean, I know a lot of bands do that, but for me, it's really important to know that I'm actually reaching somebody.
I know you're probably sick of being asked this and it being referenced to you, but Julian Lennon is your stepbrother. Has that had an, has, you know, having a musical family influenced the way that that you approach music, do you think?
I came from kind of two worlds. So on my mom's side, it was very quaint and, you know, these, she was writing songs and it was a very musical family as well. And I grew up with, surrounded by that and, you know, the arts and stuff. And then on the other side, you know, there was this sort of fame kind of celebrity aspect. So I think for me, what I learned mostly was that, you know, you don't follow your dreams because you want to be famous or rich. You follow your dreams because you love what you're doing, because, you know, that part of it isn't necessarily fun, you know. So I think it kind of really grounded me and has made me very sure about what I'm doing. And I always say, like, if I'm not enjoying what I'm doing, I'm not going to do it. So there, you know, it makes it so that I'm not really willing to compromise on too much.
That was Chloe Charles talking to Katie Bilboa then. Chloe's new album, Break the Balance, is out now and she's currently on tour. ChloeCharles.com is the place to find out all the details. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Wes Anderson's bewitching new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, is a chaotic and charming concoction concerned with concierges, heirlooms, Middle European manners, the ties that bind, and war. What a wonderful rush it is. Amongst its embarrassment of riches of an ensemble cast, led by Ralph Fiennes, is Saoirse Ronan, a confectioner's daughter and the film's great object of affection. In New York, Megan Billings spoke to Saoirse about making such a wonderful caper.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
And so my life began. Junior lobby boy in training under the strict command of Monsieur Gustave H. Many of the hotel's most valued and distinguished guests came for him.
I love you.
I love you. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
What I found really interesting is that it was a very eclectic mix that we had in this film anyway. You know, they're all very different kinds of actors. They've all got different styles and different methods when they work. And, you know, Harvey Keitel went and stayed in the prison that he shot in for the night. And it was like this freezing cold Polish prison or something. I didn't. I stayed in the hotel. But it was interesting to just be part of such a massive group, a massive kind of ensemble, and have everyone be so different and kind of influence you in different ways and have very different conversations with everyone every night, because we always had dinner together. But yeah, it was exciting. I mean, the most exciting thing for me was just getting to work with Wes, and I was so curious to see how he would work on set. I knew it was probably going to be a very specific approach and he would be quite meticulous about the detail in what I did and the set and the look of the film, and he was, and it was great. It was really nice to have that kind of clarity with everything.
You've nothing to fear. You're always anxious before you travel. I admit you appear to be suffering a more acute attack on this occasion, but truly and honestly, oh dear God, what have you done to your fingernails?
I beg your pardon?
This diabolical varnish, the colour is completely wrong.
Oh really, don't you like it?
It's not that I don't like it. I am physically repulsed.
He's so well known, really, for being so whimsical, and you said it yourself, like a storybook. It was like a storybook. Mm-hmm. And there's these kind of pieces that are so comical and have no real purpose, like the birthmark on your face of Mexico was so silly.
It's funny though, because when I watch the film, I don't even think about it. I think all of us, because I had it every single day, we just like don't consider that, oh yeah, she has Mexico on her right cheek. But everyone obviously always talks about it. I mean, that's what I love about his films. And I watched the Prada commercial that he did, or the Prada short film that he did the other day. And there's so much in it that's just extra detail, that's just a little bit of extra colour added to a world or a character or something like that. And it's just delightful. It's lovely. And yes, it might not be necessary or realistic, but it's fun. And it's so enjoyable every time he does something like that, you know?
Don't take less than half the retail asking price. Also,
zero. I'm a baker.
You're a pastry chef. One of the
best in the region. I'm not a fence, if that's the term. I don't trade in stolen property.
Hide this.
No.
Okay, but take it anyway.
Did you have a favourite scene to film?
My favourite scene to do was when we're on the little merry-go-round and he gives me the romantic book of poetry. That was a really sweet scene for me and Tony, I think. I think it was my last day and I had a terrible cold and I didn't really have much of my voice left. So we were out in the freezing cold. We did it like around the corner from the hotel. They just set up this little fairground and they had all these little boys and like little shorts, and one of them had a whistle that he kept blowing and just like incessant whistling in between takes. Yeah, and it was lovely. And so with every single take, he'd get us to speed it up a little bit more and speed it up a little bit more. And that's another thing that I think is really interesting about his stuff, is that everything is quite quick. There's a pace to everything. Everything's pretty fast. And somehow, even though that's very theatrical and technically it's not very realistic, I feel like because he doesn't dwell on anything, it makes it more realistic in a way. It makes it's less dramatic. It's like it should be the opposite, but it's not. And that's something that he seems to really push for in his films, which I really like.
And now that you've finished and you've seen the final product, what's kind of your opinion? What's kind of your favourite element of it?
I love it. I knew I would. I had forgotten that there was this line in the script, but at the very end, when F. Murray Abraham is talking about the hotel, and Jude says to him, you know, did you keep it for all the, you know, the drama and the colourful people that were there and all the characters and everything? And he said, no, I kept it for her. I kept it for Agatha and their child and the two kind of precious years that they had together in this place. And that's what that represented for him now. And I thought that that was a really lovely sentiment. And that's something, again, that Wes does so effortlessly and does it so well in every single one of his films. He doesn't dwell on it. He just kind of mentions it and that's enough. So I really liked that about the film.
Call the police. We're pressing charges. This criminal has plagued my family for nearly 20 years. He's a ruthless adventurer and a con artist who preys on mentally feeble, sick old ladies. And he probably fucks them, too.
I go to bed with all my friends.
That was Saoirse Ronan speaking to Megan Billings from our New York bureau. The Grand Budapest Hotel is out now in various markets. If it's not on at a cinema near you now, it will be over the coming weeks. So keep your eyes peeled. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, where we're finishing the show next with a trip to this year's Armoury Show.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. The Armoury Show, once New York's leading fair for modern and contemporary art, and now duking it out with London's British upstart Frieze, took place recently, welcoming a total of 205 exhibitors divided between the two piers that extend from central Manhattan to the Hudson River. It's the fourth year for the Armoury Focus section, which highlights the artistic landscape of a specific region. And this time round, China was in the spotlight. We sent Pauline Eiferman to speak with Philip Tinari, director of the Ulan Center for Contemporary Art in Beijing, who curated this year's Armoury Focus.
This year, I was invited to put something together about the part of the world that I know and where I live, which is China. I've been in Beijing for about 10 years. And working in contemporary art the whole time, and it was a great opportunity to really bring an assortment of artists and galleries, and even with the symposium of other kinds of thinkers and practitioners here to New York to kind of exhibit. But at the core of the section, you have 16 booths. Many of them are solo presentations of younger artists. Some of them are more curated presentations of historical material. There's not an overarching theme. It's kind of an open platform. It's an idea of using the format of the fair to showcase some of the strength and diversity of the contemporary art scene in China right now, hopefully in a way that's a little bit unexpected. I mean, what you won't see here are the 5 or 10 Chinese artists that most people know in the U.S. Instead, we're focusing on a newer generation and on maybe some of the more overlooked but also very important moments in this 35-year history of contemporary art in China.
And why do you think 2014 makes sense to have China as the focus?
Interestingly, it turns out to be a nice moment for contemporary Chinese art in the U.S. There was a major show at the Rubel Collection that opened during Art Basel Miami Beach that included many of the artists who are present here. There was also still running at the Metropolitan a great exhibition called Ink Art, passed as president in Chinese contemporary art, which is, from a very traditional perspective, looking to articulate, you know, what makes contemporary art in China so special and different. And there have been just a number of other kind of happenings around this period. You know, Ai Weiwei's show is coming to the Brooklyn Museum next month. It kind of created a nice background and context for this presentation, which of course lasts only 4 days or 5 days.
Can you talk about 2 or 3 artists that are represented in this show?
To give you a sense of kind of some of the range, well, let's start with Xu Zhen, who's the commissioned artist, the armory artist. This is a program that's always been part of the fair where a single artist is invited to create an addition to benefit MoMA, and then they have a hand in all of the collateral surrounding the fair, so all of the materials and advertisements that you might see. And Xu Zhen has lent a great series of his work called Under Heaven, which are these paintings made with a baker's kind of cake frosting applicator. They're talking about abstraction and impasto and kind of things intrinsic to painting, but they're doing that in a way that kind of evokes this very direct connection between seeing and wanting. They also just make for great backdrops. And we have another piece of his at the center of this presentation called Action of Consciousness, where you actually have a sort of generic white cube. It looks like a booth that you can't get inside. It's made from the same walls. And actually trapped in there are a few performers who are throwing sculptures into the air. So every few seconds you see one, I just saw one right now, appear over the edges of the cube. And they're the sorts of sculptures that we're allowed to and expected to understand after seeing them for just a fraction of a second. Juxtapositions of very basic elements, you know, a Roman column with a Chinese lantern on top, you know, pieces that you can get right away. And that's, I think, a reference to how we tend to look at things in these kinds of situations. You know, there's so many people here right now, and I think everyone ducks into and out of the booths and makes their own snap judgments about what they're seeing. And Xu Zhen has been great for kind of putting that, really implicating the viewer in the act of looking at art. We have a lot of younger artists who come from that sort of generation as well. I mean, one trend you might see in paintings by people like Zhao Yao or Li Shurei is abstraction, you know, a lack of identifiably Chinese elements, whatever those might be, and a commitment to more conceptual, process-based ways of making images and objects. I'm excited about some of the historical stuff we have here, too. I mean, the booth right next to us is a solo presentation of an artist named Chen Haiyan, who is in her 60s, and she's a printmaker at the China Academy of Art, which is a leading school in Hangzhou. And she's been making these wonderful woodblock prints based on her dreams since the 80s, since the mid-80s. It's a very wide range of work, and it's some 30 artists, it's 17 galleries, it's a sampling. And the great thing about it being an art fair is that it was organized in just a few months, 6 months or so. So it's a very real-time offering of what's happening in China now, because, you know, museum shows take a few years to put together, and China changes really quickly. So paradoxically, the fair format ends up being a way to give a very timely sense of what's going on.
That was Philip Tenari, director of the Ulan Centre for Contemporary Art in Beijing, speaking to Pauline Eiferman at New York's Armory Show. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be getting all the highlights from this year's South by Southwest and soaking up all the sun and the best bits from the Marrakesh Biennale. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, ably assisted by the blonde bombshell, Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session and new album Break the Balance. Here is Chloe Charles with Tarot. Thanks for tuning in. Do, 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 do.
Nothing that you could say couldn't make me feel this way. I'm falling slowly into gloom. Nothing that you could do couldn't make me feel so blue. I'm walking blindly into you. But the poppies grow at the base of the tree that screams my name. The light in the water leaves a trace on the leaves in the ripples that read my fate. Do, da do, da do. The tines that we bought just to pay off our cost is a tidal wave that we can't delay. The oceans, the tables, the life course we enable acquires bumps in character, dense in strength that's visible, miles and miles of travel and meetings of souls. But the poppies grow at the base of the tree that screams my name. The light in the water leaves a trace on the leaves in the ripples that read my fate. Only time can tell the end of our days and the tarot cards that the gypsies bear. Die.